Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. At 95, Peter Drucker is a living legend, one of the world's most respected thinkers on management and much more. He helped shape many of today's leaders and great corporations in his six decades as a journalist, teacher, consultant, and author of more than 35 books. Peter Drucker made the study of management theory a respected discipline. He has a brimming lifetime of wisdom to share and expertise that reaches far beyond the confines of the Fortune 500. Drucker was born in Vienna in 1909. He studied law in Germany, then moved to London to escape the Nazis, and later to the United States. In 1945, his book, Concept of the Corporation, based on 2 years studying General Motors, became an instant bestseller. Since 1971, he's taught at Claremont Graduate University, which in 87 named its business school after him. He is the ultimate guru to generations of business leaders, to students of what makes organizations tick. What you will hear tonight is an unusual interview. Peter Drucker is still active. His latest book is The Daily Drucker, but he has lost most of his hearing. When he spoke with me from Claremont, California, an assistant listened in to type out my questions. Drucker read and responded on issues from management to the future of the planet. His words are deliberate, but stick with this conversation and you will be rewarded. Peter Drucker, welcome to On Point.
Good afternoon, Mr. Ashbrook. I'm very happy to be able to talk to you today. It's a great honor, and I appreciate it, and I look forward to your questions.
Peter Drucker, let me ask you a very simple one first. You've been writing and consulting and teaching for more than six decades now. You recently had your 95th birthday last month. How does it feel to be looking at the world now from a 95-year-old vantage point?
Well, it makes me feel very old, but not too much has changed in my very limited outlook. I used 40 years ago to work primarily with businesses. The last 30, 35 years, I've worked primarily with nonprofits, though I still have a few old business clients. And the people with whom I've worked have mostly retired, and I'm working with new people, very interesting people. It hasn't changed quite that much.
And I have to ask you just another light question. At age 95, to look out on the scene there in California and have a governor who, with your background in Vienna, a governor who shares your charming accent. Are you surprised by that with Arnold Schwarzenegger's rise to power?
Well, Governor Schwarzenegger is a surprise. I never met him. I think he's a very able man. He's about as different from me as anybody could possibly be. By background, the only thing we share is the accent. He even comes from a totally different part of Austria. And I left long before he was born. I left 77 years ago. So I'm not particularly impressed by another Austrian. I've known too many.
Peter Drucker, you're good to humor our questions. But we know our time with you is limited, and we want to make the most of it. You've been so influential in your lifetime in writing about, in consulting, in teaching about management. Just an absolute breakthrough thinker and communicator. And you have ranked management among the major social innovations of the post-war era. Why? What, in your view, does society owe to management?
Well, because it is, you know. The word management was coined in 1911 or 1910. It was unknown before that. It's a very recent innovation. before that, you assumed, everybody assumed that the owner ran a business. Non-owners, professionals came in the late, well, just before World War I, simultaneously in the U.S., J.P. Morgan invented the professional manager in this country. In Japan and in Germany, and there were total innovation and really only accepted after World War I. So this is a new social function which made possible a new society, a society of organizations. And let me say that while business management was the first one to emerge, it is not the most important one. The most important ones are the managements of non-businesses which make possible a developed society. Hospitals, universities, churches, they're also the more interesting ones because they have to define what they mean by results in a business. Profit and loss determines what is meant by results. You ask me, how do you define the results of that large church I'm working with, which has grown from 500 to 6,000 members? What are results of Claremont Graduate University? They are much more important and much more difficult and much more interesting, okay?
You know, ever since the publication of your path-breaking book, The Practice of Management, I guess 50 years ago now, you've been educating managers, book after book, dozens at this point. Give us the core of the Peter Drucker message. What's the essential Drucker message to management, and in particular to today's 21st century manager?
I would say that I always ask the same three questions, whether I'm dealing with a business or with a church or a university, and whether it's American or Japanese makes no difference. The first question is, what is your business? What are you trying to accomplish? What makes you distinct? The second question is, how do you define results? And that's a very tough question, and much tougher in a non-business than in a business. And the third question is, what are your core competences? What do you have to do with, I say excellence, but let's say great competence, to have results? And that's really all. And there is no great difference between this century and the last century, only there are so many more organizations. We have become a society of organizations in the last 100 years, and where managers were very rare and you could depend on the naturals, you now need enormous numbers of them. That's all. So you have to organize it.
You speak of management in all of your work as a practice. And I wonder what you mean by that exactly. And what about what's called management science? Is there a difference between practice and management science?
I very rarely speak of management science. Management is a practice like medicine. There's medical science and there are medical sciences to support. And management is a practice. The results are not in theory, but in what happens. And the management sciences are support. And just as the medical sciences are the support of the practitioner, and they enable an ordinary physician to have results which 100 years ago would have been miracles. They don't make him a miracle worker. And so in management sciences are the tools. And you need to be a master of your tools. That's it.
So with all these organizations we have today, Peter Drucker, and so many business schools in particular, charged with educating new managers, new leaders. How are American business schools doing in that mission?
I think it's a great mistake to say that management and schools are charged with educating leaders. They are charged with educating competent mediocrities to do competent work. That's true of a medical school. It is not charged with educating leaders. It's charged with educating physicians who don't kill too many people. That's true of law schools. They're charged with educating people who can draft a decent will, not with legal leaders. You can't educate leaders. You can educate leaders in the sense that leaders need to learn a lot. But the purpose of a professional school is to educate competent mediocrity in large numbers. And that is what we are trying to do. Whether we do it well or not, I don't know. That's another matter.
But then in an era of organizations, as you say, when society is structured of organizations, how do we work to get sufficient numbers of very competent managers or even very competent leaders? What can be done to ensure that stream?
That question was answered 350 years ago with the reorganization of the medical schools in 16th century, early 17th century Holland, and 16th and early 17th century Scotland. You have to give people tool competence, and you have to set standards, and you have to get across what are the key questions. So you don't start out, this is 1650, you don't start out by saying, as the medieval medical school did, how do you teach medical leaders? You start out by asking, as the 17th century medical school said, how do you teach ordinary people to do a conscientious diagnosis? What questions must they ask? What records must they keep? What feedback do they need? So that people who are only conscientious do a reasonably decent job in most cases. And that is what you can teach. And you ask it very much the same questions. What is our business? What are results in this enterprise? And that's a very tough question. What needs to be done? And what are the priorities? And who has to understand what we are trying to do? The questions are 350 years old, the answers old. And they are no different in any profession. They are what distinguishes a profession. And perhaps not everybody can learn it, but pretty much everybody can learn it if he or she works hard enough. I don't believe in that. Let me say bluntly. All that talk about leaders is dangerous nonsense. It is a cop-out. Forget about it. It's a thing. And I'm very unhappy in this century, or rather, with Hitler and Stalin and Mao as the great leaders, maybe the greatest leaders in hundreds of years, that anybody wants leaders. That said, with those examples of misleaders, we should be very much afraid of leaders. We should say, what do they stand for? What are their values? Can we trust them? And not, do they have charisma? We should be very unhappy with charisma. We have had much too much of it the last 100 years. If that makes me very unpopular, I hope I am.
We're talking this hour with the legendary scholar of management and human organization, Peter Drucker. His new book is The Daily Drucker, 366 Days of Insight and Motivation for Getting the Right Things Done. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's return now to my interview with the celebrated writer and thinker on management, Peter Drucker. Peter Drucker, if you're so skeptical of that kind of high-profile, high-charisma leadership, what do you make of the recent era of kind of Superman CEOs that we've just come through, and for that matter, of supersized compensation for American executives?
I'm old enough to remember Franklin Roosevelt and Harry Truman. And while Roosevelt was a great leader, Truman was the best president we had and the one who accomplished the most, who was not the high-profile leader, but on the contrary, everybody underrated him, including he himself. So I'd have very little use for the Superman CEO, and the high salaries, I think, are a scandal. I think J.P. Morgan, who was certainly not averse to money, said in 1906 that any organization, any company, in which the top people get more than 20 times what the average people get, is mismanaged, and he refused to invest in it. That is still a good rule, and by that rule, I wouldn't invest in a great many of our companies. By the way, let me say, the CEOs, I have known the effective ones, and I've known quite a few, did not see themselves as supermen. They built a team. They were team leaders.
You've just talked about leadership in disparaging terms almost, and coupled it with references to Mao and Hitler and Stalin. It's been said that you see management itself, proper management, as a kind of metaphysical bulwark against fascism. Is that true, and how does it fill that function?
Well, I don't see management as a bulwark. I see functioning organizations in a society as a bulwark, and they depend on management as their organ. The present tendency to look at management as if it were something by itself, nonsense. A management exists for the sake of an organization. It is the servant of the organization. And any management that forgets that is a mismanagement.
If a manager or American managers in general don't look at their role that way these days, what are the consequences for the economy, for the country?
Well, the organization is likely to go down pretty fast, and it does. What were the consequences of Mao and Hitler? They mismanaged and destroyed their countries. What are the consequences of misleadership in any organization? We see enough of it. They destroy the organization. Managers, administrators are servants. And the moment they forget that, they do damage.
Can you look at entire nations as managers or leaders? And if so, how do you assess America's current leadership role in the world?
Now we don't have the next 30 days to discuss that question. Can you look at a nation as a manager? No. When you look at a nation as a nation, you look at the church as a church, And the idea that you manage a church the way you manage a chain of retail stores, no. There are certain things in common. They both employ people. But you ask, what are results for this organization? And they're quite different in a retail store from a church. And you manage for results. You don't manage for power. Now, as to America's role in the world, fortunately, thank God, we are no longer dominant. We are still militarily dominant, but we are no longer politically dominant, thank goodness. It is very dangerous to be the superstar. With China and India and the European Union emerging very fast, we are fast becoming just another big, great power. And that will be very hard to swallow, especially as we have had 30 years of delusions of grandeur, not because we were strong, but because the rest were so weak. And our world economy is emerging again, in which America is not even the foremost power. That's probably the European Economic Union rapidly. And we will have to learn to be one of, make it half a dozen, major players. And America's role in the world increasingly will have to be one of equals. It's a very different world economy, but it is not going to be the big bully and the big boss. It is, as we are finding out in Iraq very fast, the total disaster of Iraq, where we have only create more turmoil. And what do we stand for in terms of values, not in terms of power? America's great strength was that it stood for values.
In 2002, Peter Drucker, President George Bush, George W. Bush, awarded you the National Medal of Freedom, a very high honor. You spoke earlier of President Truman and of FDR and their competencies. How would you assess George W. Bush, graduate of Harvard Business School, as a national manager, as a leader?
I am sorry, I never answer questions about politics. One assesses a president 20 years after he has disappeared. We are now beginning to understand Harry Truman, and he's emerging as a very great president. And we are beginning to realize that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was much less, great is the wrong word, much less weighty than we all thought at the time. And I think the time has not yet come. I think we are not even able yet to assess his father.
That's fair enough. At 95, I guess you get to take the long view. Let's turn for a moment, Peter Drucker. You coined the term knowledge worker, and of course, the world is full of knowledge workers now. What are the special challenges of managing knowledge workers?
I am wrestling with this, and I have been for 30 years. How do you make the knowledge worker productive? Knowledge, by definition, is highly specialized. Nobody is very good knowing many things. Let me see. A journalist, and I'm an old one, is very good at being able to grasp the essence of other people's knowledge and projecting it. That doesn't mean that he knows anything about psychology. He knows how to write about it and make it accessible to the laity. And a good journalist can do that, has learned to listen. But that doesn't mean that he knows anything about the subject he writes about, except how to make it accessible. and a good urologist knows an enormous amount about the bladder and the kidney, that doesn't mean that he knows anything about astronomy. Knowledge is exceedingly specialized. And so knowledge workers have to be managed, but by itself a specialist, a specialty is not productive. It's got to be integrated with the knowledge of others. And to manage knowledge workers is to make them effective as specialists and integrate them into a team of knowledge workers. The second thing is that knowledge workers are basically, I wouldn't say loners, but soloists, and interested in their own narrow area. And in order to make them effective, you have to bring that into a constellation. So you have to, as managing knowledge workers, you have to be their projector, their eyes and ears, but also their tongue. Mm-hmm. And finally, they don't, as a rule, want to become managers. They want to stay in their specialty and get the pay and the privileges of management that they don't want to manage. Good knowledge workers want to keep on working on theirs in their specialty. Mm-hmm. That's a very tough challenge, especially when the public prestige and the pay goes for management. And so you have to develop the career ladder for the professional specialist.
Peter Drucker, there's so much we want to ask you, and it's so wonderful to hear your thoughts. Let me take another turn. In 1993, you wrote a book called Post-Capitalist Society. What is the post-capitalist society, and when will we arrive at it? Will we?
We are in the post-capitalist society. Very much so. We have moved into the information society. Nothing is easier than to get money today, any place, if you have the information. It used to be the other way around. Mm. We are in an information society. Anybody with a PC, and that means today anybody, everybody, certainly in developed countries, has direct access to all the information in the world and is beginning to learn to use it. Not my generation, I'm 95, but my grandson, my 24-year-old grandson, who is a graduate student at MIT, can get any information immediately. So we are living already in a knowledge society. You can compete no longer by having money, but by making knowledge productive. And we in this country so far have been ahead of this. But not very long. We have to work very hard. The competition is going to be very tough.
Peter Drucker, you've always expressed great confidence in free markets. And you've been a great consultant to businesses, but you've also expressed reservations about capitalism itself. With the advent of the knowledge society, are your concerns about capitalism now irrelevant? Are they part of history, or do you still have them?
Free markets have their severe limitations, but they are infinitely better than any alternative we had, especially as they're self-correcting pretty fast. When they make mistakes, and they make plenty, they correct themselves within a fairly short period. Capitalism is always a danger that an economy, a society, and organization are balancing acts. The main job of a management is to balance short-term results and long-term results and market standing and innovation and so on. Management is a balancer, and it's above all a balancer between the different expectations of its constituents. And the first constituent is not the shareholder. The first constituent is the consumer. If you don't satisfy the consumer, there's nothing else you can do. First comes the consumer. And then you have to be able to attract able people and hold them. And the first sign of a company or an organization going downhill is when it stops attracting top people. The American Railroad was at the top of the mountain at the time of World War One, and then during World War One and afterwards, it stopped attracting the best people, which it had been doing from 1870 till 1914. And 20 years later, when the challenge came, those people who came in the 20s, who were not the top people, were unable to meet it and became awfully close to having to nationalize the railroads because they were on the point of collapse. So capitalism is in danger of overbalancing always. And the job of leadership, whether in the political sense or in the business, is to restore the balance as it is needed at the time, because that changes. Yes, it is a continued concern, and capitalism is better placed to satisfy it than any other system, precisely because it is pluralist and because different businesses, organizations, universities, if you go to France, all universities have to follow the same way. And so the French university lost its leadership position in the world, because there was not enough experimentation. The strength of the American college system is we experiment. And Harvard does things totally different from the Catholic Women's College or from the Claremont Colleges. And that's our strength. And that's the strength of capitalism. And no other system can have it because no other system can be pluralist.
We're talking this hour with Peter Drucker, the first serious student of management theory. His new book is The Daily Drucker. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Now, more of my conversation with the legendary student of management theory, Peter Drucker. You've been very skeptical, written very skeptically about government over the years, and that skepticism has been very influential in this country. What's your sense of the future of government, the role of government looking ahead, Peter Drucker?
You know, one of the things one learns if one gets to be my age is not to predict. And I'm skeptical about any institution that does not have severe restraints and limits on its power. I'm skeptical of power. I'm an old conservative in which power without authority is the ultimate political evil. And government that is not limited and restrained and confined to the jobs government can do. There are many things the government cannot do. Government is a very poor doer. Government is a norm setter, not a doer. And if government attempts to do, it usually fails for the simple reason that government cannot abandon anything. Government, once the government does something, it's supposed to be for the ages. Government cannot abandon easily and hangs on to things forever and forever and forever till they're totally bankrupt. And even then it hangs on. And in the 20s, as in World War I, government performed miracles. Everybody knew in 1911 that a modern war could only last 60 days because after 60 days or 90 days, any government would be bankrupt. So it was, and it kept on for 4 years. And so government became, well, suffering from megalomania, believing that it could do everything. That was the way we came out of World War I, especially in Europe, but in this country too. And we have learned in the meantime, and the last 30, 40 years, we have been cutting back on government every place to the things government is good at doing. This government is still doing too many things, and still doing too many things badly. We already see the emergence of a few great powers, 6 to 8 in the world. Not that the little powers will do exceedingly well. Nobody is more prosperous today than Denmark or Holland, precisely because they are small. But they can afford to be small because they are protected by the big powers. And government in the future, well, we are learning what is government good at and what are the right sizes for government. There are certain things a small country does much better than a big one because everybody knows everybody. There are certain things only a big country can do. There are certain things only a constellation of countries like the European Union can do. It alone can probably manage money and credit, banking. Bank can be no longer really function within a small central bank, small country. And so we are learning what is the proper role of government under what conditions. And government in the future will, I hope, not be dominated by one big theory such as we came out of in World War I, after World War I, that dominated till the collapse. The communism is not a rejection of the 19th century. It is the culmination of the 19th century. And it has collapsed. The basic beliefs that government is everything and can do everything. We have to learn what is government doing well and what should it not do and what should it delegate and how should it delegate. We are beginning to learn. So 100 years, 50 years from now, I hope government will look very different.
You're a wise man and an old man, and there's certain kinds of questions we're always tempted to put to a wise old man.
No, I'm not wise. I'm just old.
We'll be the judge of that. There's a lot of unease today, I sense, among Americans about where the country is headed, about where the world is headed. So, my wise old friend, what do you think? What's your sense of the direction the world is heading? Is it all right?
Well, I think anybody who is not uneasy about the direction in which the world is moving is blind and deaf. The belief in progress, which we inherited from the 18th century, is gone. The belief in the all-powerful, all-wise government, which we inherited from World War I, is gone. The belief in a Western-dominated world is going. The new world is emerging with China and India, and by no stretch of the imagination are the Western, nor will the Westernize themselves the way Japan did 150 years ago. The world we don't understand. We don't know the extent to which a European Union will actually become a union or remain a loose confederation. We don't understand, can't predict the way Mercosur Latin America is going. We are in a period of transition as fundamental as the 18th century before the Napoleonic Wars. So, not to be uneasy about the direction of the world is being blind and deaf. Is it going to be a world in which certainly it's going to be a world that is not going to be dominated by any one great power? That's going to be a very difficult thing to accept for Americans. Most of us still see a world, the world of 1860, in which America was the only great power and the only functioning economy. Today, there are, while the European Union is a bigger economy than the U.S. economy, the Asian Union, China, is trying to build a Chinese free trade zone that will be bigger than America, both as producer and consumer. India is rapidly emerging as something quite different. So we will have to learn that it's going to be a very different world, and the world in which different values will have to coexist. It will not be a Western-dominated world. It will have Western values and Western productivity and Western competitiveness, and it'll be held together by information, not by power. That is the direction we are going, and not to be uneasy about it is to be blind and deaf. It's going to be a very difficult and rough transition time, 30 years of transition.
Peter Drucker, I have a final question for you, and I hope you'll humor me and not consider me too greedy. You've lived a long life and focused intensely on life and how it's lived. Now you're 95. What about an afterlife? What about God? How do you think about the moment of transition that you are inevitably approaching?
Well, I happen to be a very conventional, traditional Christian, period. And I don't think about it. I'm told, not my job to think about it. My job is to say, yes, sir.
That must be very comforting.
It is. And I say every morning and every evening, praise be to God for the beauty of His creation. Amen.
Peter Drucker, thank you so very, very much for your time. We're very grateful to you, and we hope we get a chance to talk again. You sound so vital. Maybe next year.
Let's hope so.
Peter Drucker, 95 and the world's foremost authority on management and society, Joining me now is our own On Point News analyst, Jack Beatty, also a longtime student of Dr. Drucker. He is author of the 1998 book, The World According to Peter Drucker, and had many conversations with the great one in the preparation of that book. Jack, there is a very large intelligence drawing on many decades of experience and that kind of almost the voice of God, though, he, considering what he just said, maybe that's sacrilege, but yeah, I'm joking, but just that kind of very, very high vantage on the affairs of men.
Yes, and, you know, he said, I'm just old, I'm not wise. But just listening to him, you hear the wisdom. And, you know, I've talked to people, business people, who say, I ask them, well, what did he tell you specifically? You know, what was, and they say, that's not what it's about. It's just being in this guy's presence. It's just having somebody of these intellectual gifts, of this moral depth, of this historical vision, reflecting on my issues, my problems.
And that scale of sweep.
And reminding me as a businessman how I fit into the scheme of things. And you, and one guy said, you come out just feeling nobler somehow and elevated by his tutelage company.
So there you hear him at the end of 2004 nearly, looking out on this world and some pretty arresting last words there about how difficult he sees these next 30 years being, this great transition he describes, wherein the United States just becomes one power of perhaps half a dozen at the table. This is a profound, profound transition. And he's warning 30 rough years for Americans minimum.
Yes, and he's at one point he said, thank God that, you know, America finally is going to be returning to the world and we're not going to have our position. He said 1860, he meant 1960, but he could as well have meant 1860 because it's that vanished. I mean, you know,
when America was the power towering above the fragmented rest of the world.
45% of the world economy, mm-hmm. world trade, and so on. Now half that and diminishing, and my gosh, just all the financial problems. But he's right. I mean, the adjustment is going to have to be made. Americans' idea of, you know, bestriding the world like a colossus, that's going to have to be accommodated to a much more pluralistic world. And the transition is going to be economic. Some people are going to perhaps lose out and some aren't. But it's also going to be psychological and sort of moral. Americans are going to have to come down off their high horses.
How brief that sole superpower moment. It seems only half a second ago that was every headline on the planet.
Yes, yes.
Peter Drucker saying, it's already ending under your feet.
And you know what? I mean, he was born in the Austro-Hungarian Empire.
The colossus of its time.
Absolute colossus of its time. And he saw that disappear. So, you know, in fact, there's a book written about it called Vanished Supremacies. You know, he knows that supremacies vanish. And he's sort of bringing a little of that perspective to say, you know, those days are gone. That imperial hubris doesn't befit a nation with the diminished role in the world that we have today. You can't scare everybody. And we have to get used to a plural world. That word comes up again and again. Plural, variety. You know, the great thing about capitalism, it allows pluralism.
Many powers, many value systems.
Many value systems. And we have to understand it's not going to be a Western pond and we're not going to be the biggest ship in it.
And all this from a man who made the study of management that kind of ring at the center of all his thinking.
Yes, and management, as he points out, in a society of organizations, where those organizations have to work in order for the society to work. And he's seen what happens when they don't work, when economic collapse comes. Fascism, communism. And he's saying, you know, he rejects the heroic vision of management, but the function is heroic, to make organizations work for people, work for the economy, work for the results that he stressed all through his time as management, not for power, for results.
Our own Jack Beatty, author of The World According to Peter Drucker. What a wonderful hour. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.